Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent Kling and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, a lot to talk about because it's earnings season. So we're going to talk a little bit of Target. We're going to talk L Brands, as well as a couple of off-price retailers. We're also going to discuss very briefly the deal that was just brokered today between Liberty Tax and Sears Hometown. You know, this episode, we had to kind of delay recording of it. I got stuck on flights on Monday. Leighton had some delays on Tuesday, so we had to push it all the way to Wednesday of this week. Interesting, though, this is actually the second episode we've ever recorded in the same room, because all of our episodes, we're usually traveling, we're in different places, here actually in the same room, so we'll see how that goes here. We might have to kick Leighton out or kick myself out midway through the show. But anyway, we begin today's show with Target. They saw a one-day record increase in their stock price after their earnings call on Tuesday. Target on everyone's mind last week with solid e-commerce gains supplementing in-store success. Saw a lot of headlines claiming that they were finally back amongst the big retailers, which was kind of odd to me because I think we've always considered them to be one of the bigger and more successful retailers. And I think what's worthy to note, this all happened despite the Target down outages in June. Remember, we talked about the impact to same-store sales being potentially around 0.1 to 0.4%, although some analysts had the number much higher. So things could have been even better for Target in the quarter, but again, a reminder that just one outage, poorly timed though it was, quickly forgotten by consumers.
Yeah, and that was an outage that we talked about in a Looking Ahead segment as well, because they had a follow-up issue, and it was supposedly unrelated to the very first one that we had discussed on the podcast, but it's something that, you know, you do have to take into consideration is the negative PR that was trending on Twitter, Instagram, pictures of store personnel that were ushering customers away from the store. That all looked to be a non-issue. And as we delve into the numbers, you see the main number discussed was Target's comparable store sales, which were up 3.4% overall. So if you compare that to that potential same store figure that we had given just a little bit ago at 0.1 to 0.4%, you can see that the 3.4% number, Trent, very solid number there. This includes, by the way, a 1.5% impact from brick and mortar transactions and a 1.8% impact from digital, as both factor into their overall numbers with Target. Of the digital impact, and we must talk about this, the company said a whopping 1.5 percentage points of the comp sales growth touched the same-day delivery fulfillment channel. And you look here and you see that it has a huge effect across all of their stores, order pickup, drive up, and shipped. So that shipped acquisition actually working out for the company. You really have to applaud executive teams that really put forward a very strong growth plan in order to create a truly omnichannel company. On a two-year stack basis, this reflects, by the way, the same store sales do a 10% boost between comp sales in digital and the brick and mortar space. E-commerce gains were also a main topic, with comps growing 34% over last year's second quarter, in line with the e-commerce growth at Walmart. Later in the call, they referenced the impact that July e-commerce promotions had on their traffic, which was in fact positive. As far as comps are concerned, they were fueled mostly by a traffic increase. Number of transactions saw a 2.4% improvement over the same quarter of last year. Transaction amount was up slightly, just 0.9%, which is lower than most inflation metrics out there. And you see that breaking it down further, Target saw somewhat of a unicorn in brick and mortar, substantial comp growth in apparel of all areas. This was credited in part to their limited time partnership with Vineyard Vines, which CEO Brian Cornell said was very well received and was one of their most successful brand partnerships ever. Essentials also saw a 5% comp growth increase. This includes food and beverage, of course, which was a sore spot for them around 2 to 3 years ago. Their adjusted earnings per share came in at $1.82, up over 20% since last year. So it's not just that same store sales revenue, but also a more profitable, more robust retailer overall. That earnings per share figure set an all-time high for Target. They saw gains in gross margin and selling, general, and administrative expenses as a percentage of sales too, fueled the solid bottom line performance. You see a lot of cost savings there, even though revenue saw a modest, for them at least, 3.6% increase. Additionally, share buybacks were a driver of earnings per share growth as they retired nearly 4.3 million shares in the second quarter. Fewer shares with increased earnings means, guess what, substantial earnings per shares that were reported for this quarter.
And Target also reaffirmed their belief that the third and fourth quarter of 2019 will be just as strong. They expect comp sales to grow around 3.4% in those quarters as well. They increased their GAAP earnings per share on both ends of their expectations by 15 cents, expecting it to come around $5.90 to $6.20 per share for the full year of 2019. All of this news, of course, sent shares skyrocketing on Wednesday morning, up over $15 from trading on Tuesday. So this would be 1 week ago Wednesday morning on August 21st. After the big pop, the share price continued to increase. It was around $85.59 at the end of the day on Tuesday of last week, but saw trading above $106 before a slight pullback on Friday, which was endemic of a larger market pullback that took place on Friday. So we're talking in this case about Friday, August 23rd. Now this, of course, set share price records for the company, who you may recall was trading under $53 a share after Amazon's purchase of Whole Foods. Like, we actually heard from some listeners that had bought into Target stock after that purchase of Whole Foods by Amazon, thinking that, hey, Target's not going to be around $53 per share for long. Those listeners, if they hung around this long, might have pulled a pretty big profit on that. I think it might be reasonable to say at this point the market reaction to that transaction was indeed an overreaction. The oft-quoted Neil Saunders mentioned that Target's own investments in their store locations has been central to this surge of late, driven in part by their fulfillment from store strategy, which we'll talk about in a bit. So as we often have to do, you know, there aren't a lot of details in just the releases, so we went to the earnings call. On this call, CEO Brian Cornell praised the company's model in the prepared statements, saying is he feels as though Target has attained an ideal position between branding, product selection, price, and digital initiatives. On the call itself, the robust Q&A revealed other details. This is a lengthy Q&A here, and the release itself was largely financially oriented, so that's why we went to the call and we went to the Q&A on the call. John Mulligan had perhaps the most quoted data in reports that came out afterwards. He's Target's COO. Mulligan said that because of their model of digital fulfillment from stores, their productivity for their brick-and-mortar presence comes in at just over $300 per square foot. Additionally, he said there's potential to increase this by over $20 per square foot if their digital fulfillment from stores continues to grow. They imagine it growing potentially to double what it is today. By fulfilling this merchandise directly from stores, Target's taking advantage of a footprint and staffing that they already have, meaning their e-commerce growth has potentially come at a lesser cost than for other retailers. And Layton, I've spent the last few weeks actually visiting some distribution centers for retailers, and it's interesting because they're having to hire a lot of different people for these distribution centers to handle fulfillment from e-commerce orders, whereas Target, they might be hiring a few in-store, but really it's about reallocating that in-store presence from employees they already have. So it hasn't affected what you would call their DCs or distribution centers all that much because they're doing so much of this fulfillment from stores. And margin on e-commerce or same-day fulfillment has been wanting from other retailers in part because of how it impacts those distribution centers. They have to kind of turn them into fulfillment centers instead. That requires a lot of investment. Instead, what Target's done is they've invested in the stores. They've done a lot of renovation in the stores. And because of this, they're pulling higher margins on some of these e-commerce trends, especially in terms of those fulfillments directly from stores and those same-day fulfillments there. Cornell also mentioned on the call that their same-day fulfillment, speaking of that, has delivered outstanding performance on the financial front, not only driving top line, but also bottom line growth as well. So crucial for retailers to figure out how they're going to make a profit on those online sales rather than the Amazon model, which is just, hey, let's try to sell as much as we can and we'll worry about the profit later. Now, speaking of fulfillment, some retailers have struggled with having their stores double as fulfillment centers. One of the reasons why they've pushed that to the distribution center front, there's had to be a significant adjustment among store leadership in terms of prioritizing employee work. And so a lot of these old guard managers are saying, hey, we still want employees to be facing store shelves, to be doing a lot of the traditional brick and mortar tasks. And Mulligan said on the call, he feels as though Target is on the forefront of analytical developments to assist in prioritization, allowing employees to know exactly what they should be doing and when. This makes it easier then for managers to delegate responsibilities as needed. It doesn't necessarily take a lot out of their hands, but it makes it an easier call for those brick and mortar managers. And they want to transcend or get beyond a first in, first out system when and where it makes sense. The sequence of order picking in particular, they feel like, should be flexible to maximize both efficiency and packing or box size. Additionally, they're implementing new data systems to analyze efficiency of packing. This is something that, you know, fulfillment and distribution centers have long had. It's just a matter of translating it now for Target to those individual stores. And what I found interesting is when they were talking about it on the call, Target isn't just using this data to crack whips and make employees work harder or faster, as it were, but also to understand underlying causes behind either superior performance or lagging performance. And maybe that's for a particular associate or a particular location or a particular day. They want to understand the underlying causes, not just that associate A might be a little bit slow at picking orders. They want to know why that's the case or why a particular store might be faster or slower at picking those orders. Still, as Mulligan mentions, about 92.7% of store sales still come from brick and mortar, which is a higher percentage than a lot of retailers we talk about on the podcast, but they're careful not to jeopardize their physical presence, just to prioritize digital fulfillment, as important as it may be to the store's future.
Food, which was noted just 3 years ago as a potential weight on Target's balance sheets, was referred to optimistically on the call. They announced this week the unveiling of a new private label brand, caught a lot of attention out there, Good and Gather, which will over time replace Archer Farms and Simply Balanced. And everybody really, Trent, is very well aware of Archer Farms. They've been around for quite some time. I actually had worked at Target many years ago. We would be stocking Archer Farms products all of the time. The reason being, fulfillment. A lot of people were buying that brand. A lot of people became acquainted with that brand. They feel like this is a good new direction for the company. The idea with the line will be to sell either organic or naturally sourced products. Alternatively, they will have some differentiated flavor lines, as we've seen over the years with Archer Farms. The rollout will most likely take place in September, with the brand eventually expected to house around 2,000 different products, as the other two brands, of course, are phased out over time. And so Good and Gather is expected to also take the same shelf space from maybe some of their Market Pantry products as well. Market Pantry, of course, being another private label brand that they've boasted over time. Something unusual for Target, this move in the food space was applauded by several analysts, including at Moody's and UBS. Speaking of private label brands, they launched their More Than Magic tween line just prior to the back-to-school season, and they are seeing positive results, although not fully impacting the second quarter. Most will probably spill into the third quarter. Additionally, their Vineyard Vines program, a pilot with Levi's, proved fruitful in 20 test stores. They are expanding their Levi's partnership to 50 stores specific to college markets, and this is something that they've been really focused on, including some of those college-centric lower square footage stores, some of those mini Target stores, if you will. While store growth has been limited, just 9 net openings, by the way, in the second quarter, all of these, those smaller format stores, they are continuing to heavily invest in remodeling their existing store base. Those remodels are focused around merchandising, of course, but also technological investments to support their same-day delivery fulfillment mechanisms. And you see here, 84 remodels were completed in the second quarter, 300 still expected for the next year as a whole. One final interesting note, Trent, Target RedCard penetration is actually down from prior years and prior quarters. Debit card penetration was down 0.5% from last year's second quarter. Target credit card penetration was down 0.2%. Again, the less action they see on this front, the fewer royalties they will receive from these card channels. This is in opposition to JCPenney's numbers around 2 weeks ago, as their card loyalty numbers were actually up over last year. And this is interesting, Trent, because this is a theme that we had talked about, and we talked about it for good reason. A lot of these cards, specifically with Target, offer rewards such as 5% off at the register, better return policies, and these are things that a lot of people are going to miss out on if they don't, in fact, use their card. And what's interesting is it's not like Target's taking a backseat to the promotion of their RedCard. They keep offering a lot of different
promotions at the point of sale, a lot of different banners. Anytime you go into either a small format store or a conventional Target, they are still promoting that card very widely.
And it's interesting. I was actually in a small format Target store earlier this week. So I was in Sausalito, California, the store just north of downtown Sausalito. And it's one of those small format stores similar to their college type formats. It was about 30,000 square feet if I had to eyeball it there. But information about their Target Red Card and signage for that Red Card is just about everywhere when you were looking around the store. We'll post some pictures from that store experience on our Instagram page, and you can follow us at Retail Podcast on either Instagram or Twitter. When we come back, we're going to kind of bounce around from several different news stories. Wanted to make sure we get a little bit of everything on this delayed episode of the Retail Focus Podcast.
Next, on to L Brands, who beat analyst estimates by over 25% in their earnings call on Wednesday. We've talked at length over the last 2 years about how much of a boon Bath & Body Works has been to not only the company as a whole, but also the malls and strip centers it inhabits. It appears as though a lot more of the same in this quarter is happening, with Bath & Body Works lapping Victoria's Secret. We move on to the earnings numbers here, and we see that Bath & Body Works showcased a solid 8% same-store sales increase, down from the 10% they had last year, and by the way, 13% in the first quarter, but still a very good, and especially for a mall or strip center-based retailer, a very good figure posted by the brand. However, Victoria's Secret continues to drag the overall brand down with a 6% loss in same-store sales. This resulted in a firm-wide 1% drop in same-store sales, as the divide between the success at Bath & Body Works and the struggles at Victoria's Secret seems to continue onward. When you divide comps between digital and brick and mortar, the difference looks even more stark. Bath & Body saw a 4% increase in stores alone, still a solid number for the current climate. Victoria's Secret's brick and mortar stores fell a whopping 9%, a veritable free fall after stemming losses a bit last year. The sales trends include the net closure of around 34 stores in the Victoria's Secret division. They closed 37 and opened one Victoria's Secret and two Pink stores. One has to think they were closing underperforming stores whose leases were either coming due very soon or were already up, meaning this number could have been potentially worse. Meanwhile, the company opened a net of 14 new Bath & Body Works stores in North America in the last quarter. For the company, this transition to weighting Bath & Body Works as the predominant brand cannot happen soon enough, in our opinion. As far as earnings per share, those were down to around 14 cents compared to 36 cents from last year's quarter. When you look, they are guiding for around negative 5 cents to 5 cents in the third quarter. Adjusted earnings beat company expectations at 24 cents. Much of the benefit, by the way, coming from taxes. They still expect full year earnings per share around $2.30 to $2.60, giving them a forward price to earnings ratio of around 7 to 8. Based on the trading over the last few weeks. In regards to the stock, it didn't so much plummet as it did continue its slow decline, marching down in the $16 range at recording this very podcast. And you see, 30 days ago, Trent, share prices were touching $26, but it has been a rough month for the company on the market.
And as we finish up talking about L Brands overall here, you know, I sat in on the earnings call. There were some interesting initiatives, and most of the Q&A was focused on Victoria's Secret, and why wouldn't it be, right? Bath & Body Works has been surging for the company, so there's not a whole lot to pinpoint there as far as room for improvement because they're doing such a good job already. I think one of the big things that was mentioned on the call was their fall merchandise mix. As they try to get better with that fall merchandise mix coming in, they feel like merchandise mix, particularly at Victoria's Secret and at Pink, has been one of the reasons why you see this falling same-store sales, why you see falling profitability at that branch of the company. What they want to do is kind of adopt good, better, best pricing, particularly at Pink coming up for the fall. And so you're going to see some lower price points integrated into Pink, which, as Leighton mentioned, they're kind of bullish on. They're opening more Pink stores than they are Victoria's Secret stores. And part of this is from Amy Houck's perspective. She's the CEO of Pink. She's looking to kind of refine that merchandise mix, but also in terms of promotional activity, they don't want to do broad-based promotional activity in the fall. They want to select certain items that they feel like will be traffic drivers to the store, and then keep the rest of the fall merchandise full price. So they want to provide a compelling reason for people to come into the store, and then they want to provide those full price items alongside the discounted items to try and make the customers basically buy up with some of these, what you would call impulse buys, or very expensive impulse buys in this case. And this is something that Stuart Bergdorfer on the call said was kind of the fun part of the business for L Brands and Victoria's Secret. One thing that I thought was interesting, they reintegrated swim into the product mix at Victoria's Secret this year, and they were talking about how much that impacted the top line. Swim delivered $30 million to the top line revenue, they figured. That's compared to $40 million in the past, but they got a late start on it. They didn't roll out a lot of their swim lines until March because they were late deciding to offer swimwear products again. So they figure if they can get that rolled out sooner next year in some of the warmer markets where swimwear becomes relevant earlier on in the year, they do have some upward mobility in that particular category, and they feel like that particular category can help Victoria's Secret now that they're kicking it back. Now, one of the interesting things for Victoria's Secret they mentioned, and I found this to be intriguing, they said that basically they're trying to transition from using 25-year-old digital platforms for their merchandise. So in terms of inventory selection, in terms of kind of the back end, they've had 25-year-old platforms. They're in the midst of updating. So they're really far behind in terms of the digital presence at Victoria's Secret. They're in the midst of updating all of those platforms here. So they're looking forward to that. Now, as far as Bath & Body Works, they mentioned that in-store traffic was actually flat. So they're not bringing in any more customers than they used to, but they're killing it on conversion with upsells and getting more people to buy full-priced items rather than the discounted items they're so well known for. What was interesting, when it came to Bath & Body Works, they were asked, you know, hey, what's your mall mix? What does it look like with the C-class malls versus A-class malls? They said, it doesn't matter what mall we're in. We are seeing success across the board. So to Layton's point here, you're seeing Bath & Body Works as one of those few stores in those C-class malls, right alongside Foot Locker, in fact, keeping traffic driven to those malls. And in some cases, you're seeing Bath & Body Works actually driving more traffic than some of the department stores that were supposed to be anchoring those malls. So I found that very interesting on the call. Overall, the company as a whole still has a way to go with Victoria's Secret and PINK. It's going to be difficult for them to be able to focus on Victoria's Secret and PINK while they're still growing Bath & Body Works, because again, most of the focus on the call, most of the focus in the Q&A was on Victoria's Secret, and you don't want them to kind of lose sight at what is driving profits and what is continuing to grow the company in Bath & Body Works. So we move on to our second quick story here, as Sears Hometown just entered into a deal. This broke earlier today with Liberty Tax Services to sell off, basically, or go private, with Liberty Tax Services buying the company, essentially. Part of the reason this is taking place, and you look at this and you say, why would a tax service be at all interested in these Sears Hometown stores? But the main reason it looks like they are is because Sears Hometown stores offer a franchising model. And you look at the past few months, really the past year, for Liberty Tax, which in and of itself is a franchise model. And they've bought Buddy's, which is a home furnishing service similar to Aaron's or Rent-A-Center. They've bought a few other franchise models, so they want to get into things that they feel like is a strong franchise model. I don't know that anyone's going to look at Sears Hometown and say, that's a franchise model that's setting the world on fire, but still a very intriguing purchase here from Liberty Tax. And what's more, a lot of questions now for Transform Holdco as to what they're going to do with their smaller format stores to now differentiate the Sears Hometown stores, or differentiate themselves from the Sears Hometown stores, which are now owned by a completely different third party, because if they're buying it out, again, Eddie Lampert's not going to be the primary shareholder.
There are a lot of different questions you have to ask with this particular transaction. One, of course, Trent, you touched on it there, but a second, a primary concern for me would be distribution. So the actual items on the shelves for these Sears Hometown stores, they were often closeout goods from Kmart's or Sears that were closed recently down the street from a lot of these Sears Hometown stores. A lot of the franchise deals actually fell through or expired here recently, just prior to the bankruptcy of Sears Holding Company. So overall, a lot of questions that have to be answered. And it is interesting here. You see Liberty Tax Service, to Trent's point, buying a lot of things here lately, really on a buying spree. It wasn't that long ago when they put in a really stout bid to buy Buddy's Home Furnishings. And you look at the overall business strategy, Trent, Liberty Tax, they're known for a tax service. And if you look them up, maybe do a simple Google search for Liberty Tax Service, they're known pretty much, their primary definition is an American company specializing in the preparation of tax returns. So what, in fact, are they going to be having to do with retail, and how are they going to make this type of Sears business profitable going forward? I think the number one answer here is the synergies they see between all of these different models. You look at Buddy's Home Furnishings. Well, guess what? They're probably going to be stocking these Sears outlet stores, or these Sears hometown stores, rather, with a number of different furnishings that all of their other store brands are going to or have carried over the recent past. And so I think the acquisition price may be a little bit much, but you know what? That was what the reorganized Sears Transform Holdco company had in mind when they basically put it up for auction here. They said that their own bid could be outbid by a third-party company coming in. What's more, Trent, by the way, and this should be noted here, is that not all of the debt is going to be financed through Liberty's holdings. So they're actually going to be looking for a little bit of a line of credit through Vintage Capital Management, which it actually wanted to buy Liberty Tax Company not that long ago, back in May. So a lot of weird things happening here. And again, you have to look at the end result. What is exactly going to happen with this type of business model? It is a franchisable model. They're looking to maybe grow over the next few years. But is it a company that can grow, especially given right now you look at the retail landscape for these types of things that they have historically in terms of appliances? That market is pretty saturated. That's not a market that you can look at and say, oh, this is hyper competitive at a point where we can jump in right now and make a very good profit. I don't think that's the case, but I am curious to see how their business model pans out, and then also how they're able to expand, potentially take advantage of some cheap real estate. So maybe get some good leasing deals with the franchisees on real estate that's been abandoned by other similar retailers with that big box format.
And as far as real estate goes, you're really looking at real estate that's 6,000 to 10,000 square feet in size. These Sears hometown stores are mostly in smaller to mid-size markets. Real estate is cheaper there as well. One of my concerns is getting people excited about the franchise model. If you're from Liberty Tax, there are several Sears hometown stores that I know of, at least personally, where the franchisees were old and they basically aged out of the business because they couldn't find a buyer for the franchise, and they ended up having to shut the franchise down, not because of lack of success, but because they wanted to retire. They were in their 70s and just wanted to get out of the game, and they didn't have a buyer waiting there, even though they saw some success on that store level. And further to your point about the appliances, we saw JCPenney and how much their margins were compressed by the appliances. We're seeing such a heavy discounting model with appliances, with Home Depot, with Lowe's, with Sears themselves. So that's going to make it very tough for these franchisees to make a solid go of it. But one thing that you do look at is the fact that Sears Hometown has had some interplay with Buddy's. In fact, Sears Hometown, interestingly enough, is the franchise owner of 8 Buddy's stores that's out there. And they said one of the reasons they did that was because they wanted to look at the rent-to-own model. And I think that's something where, you know, Sears Hometown might be, and Liberty Tax specifically, might be seeing a little bit of momentum there, because you do see that upcharge for appliances. You see much higher margins there as long as people make good on their payments. So I think that's something to certainly watch for in Sears Hometown going forward. But again, the question now for Transform Holdco, how are they going to differentiate their Sears Home stores, which are, again, smaller format stores that Eddie Lampert has been bullish on? They're actually opening new stores of those. How are they going to differentiate those stores from Sears Hometown stores? It's a question that honestly both franchises have to ask, because the Sears brand name at this point doesn't carry a lot of equity with it. It's been pretty well tarnished by what's going on and what's gone on in the last 5 years. One last thing I did want to mention here in kind of this quick news segment before we move on to our last story, we've been talking about retail stores that we've visited, and while we're talking about Sears and Sears Holdings and Transform Holdco, went to a Kmart actually in Ypsilanti, Michigan, or just south of there, and it was interesting because the Kmart itself posted pictures on our Instagram, so you might have seen it if you follow our Instagram page, but they were almost completely out of stock of back-to-school items, and yet it was about a week until school started, the assistant manager told me there. Good thing in that obviously they're driving traffic to sell those products. Bad thing in that they were out of stock, and so they were having to turn people away, basically, that wanted those particular products coming up. So, again, positive traffic in the store. They talked to the assistant store manager. They're actually doing a complete reset in pantry currently to restore inventory levels and get rid of stale products. Basically, in this case, quite literally stale products, because we're talking about food. That's what they refer to in their pantry section. Also, there's some paper goods in their pantry section there as well. Next up on the docket, home goods. So they're going to do a complete reset of home goods there, including things like sheets, things like curtains, turning over the inventory, restoring inventory to really the levels that they were seeing 5 to 10 years ago. The assistant store manager, very excited about it, but she said it was keeping staff busy in doing these resets. And one other thing I'll note from the store, a couple of things actually. One, they still have some work to do. It's some old music and video signage up in seasonal areas. And of course, we've talked about how they're compressing their seasonal areas in most Kmart stores. But all the lights were out. I was there at 9 p.m. All the lights were out in the Kmart parking lot. In that strip center, the lights were on for every other business except in front of the Kmart. And one of our listeners pointed out on our Instagram page, sometimes this is the landlord's doing. And we don't know who's doing this is in this particular circumstance. It could be Kmart deciding to save on their energy bills by just leaving the lights out at night. Maybe the landlord has some issue with replacing the lights or not turning those on in front of the Kmart store. But it was just interesting. All the other lights, there was a Dollar Tree in that complex as well. They were on for every other store, but in front of the Kmart, it was pitch black dark in the middle of the night there. So kind of interesting there in Ypsilanti, Michigan. Well, coming up after this quick break, we'll talk about off-price stores. So stick around. You know, 88% of financially successful people read at least 30 minutes per day. They're hungry for knowledge. They continuously seek self-improvement and learning every chance they get. And Blinkist gets you there faster than you can imagine. You know, if you're like me, the list of books you want to read or those that people suggest you read is never ending and always expanding. Leighton, this is, I believe, your second visit to my house in Colorado. You've seen all the books lying around there. You know this is absolutely true, but our sponsor Blinkist has solved that long list of must reads once and for all.
Well, Trent, I was trying to figure out if you were a hoarder or if you just like to read a lot, but apparently it is the latter. Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands, not hundreds, thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most impactful elements so you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes, all from your phone. With Blinkist, you will expand your knowledge and learn more in just those 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen almost anywhere. And I like to listen to Blinkist, for those who care, while I'm at work, because I don't do a lot at work anymore, and I kind of drift off aimlessly, but I like to listen to a lot of inspirational books, things that keep the juices flowing mentally, so to speak. And Trent, I know that Blinkist library is now massive, from a lot of timeless classics like Freakonomics to the current Amazon bestseller like Getting Things Done.
Yeah, I like thinking fast and slow. I mentioned that on a previous episode. I've been listening to a lot of Blinkist because, as I've mentioned, been traveling all across the country. It's been perfect for that. And right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. You can cancel at any time. That's Blinkist.com/retail. Well, finally, we wrap up our news segment with two earnings calls touching on off-price. First, we'll discuss Ross, who we actually haven't talked about in a while on the show. And then we'll talk about how the acceleration of their off-price pivot and purchase of a formerly bankrupt Gordman's brand has saved stage from disaster, at least for now.
Yeah, first we dig into Ross earnings, and we should mention from the outset that Ross is not just Ross, but also their ever-expanding DD's Discounts concept as well. By the way, Trent, I'm around a lot of DD's Discounts in Orange County and Los Angeles County. They are absolutely everywhere. So when we talked about them previously on the podcast, you and I hadn't really come face-to-face with that particular brand, but they are, in fact, in a lot of different pockets throughout Southern California.
Overall, it was more of the same for the company as a whole, with same-store sales rising 3% on top of 5% comps in the same quarter just a year ago. This was after softer comps in the company's first quarter in 2019 that, again, we didn't talk about because it's been a little while for Ross, but top-line revenue for this quarter was up 6% to $4 billion, noting a lot of positivity throughout the store. And from there, you see net earnings increased from $389 million a year ago to $413 million this year. And earnings per share came in at $1.14, a 10-cent increase from a year ago, and a 2-cent beat on analyst expectations. However, the story many outlets picked up on was a tepid forecast for the rest of the year from Ross. And for one, the company was upfront about cost timing benefits they've reaped in the first two quarters, around 2 cents per share, by the way. That is expected to be reversed in the second half of the year. And this makes sense, as costs typically incurred in the first half move a little slower into the second half of their year. Their same-store sales guidance for the third and fourth quarters of 2019 is also pretty low for the off-price segment, sitting around just 1-2% in the positive range. Adding to this concern, the company is guiding for potential impacts from those tariffs. You see all of the tariff news really making the stock market go up and down with all of the different rumors. Do we have a deal done? Is it going to be delayed? What are going to be the downsides if we don't get something done as far as trade negotiations with China? You see a 10% impact there on apparel and footwear sourced in China, expecting that specific tariff to hurt their bottom line somewhat. Most companies have come out and said that they will pass tariff costs onto the consumer. However, in this particular release on the call, Ross CEO Barbara Rentler indicated that Ross may have to absorb some of these costs in order to keep the lower price points on goods so that customers really come into the stores and they're getting what they've come to expect over time. That said, it remains to be seen how much this will truly impact Ross, and if it does, whether the impact will be immediate. After all, the way they really source their inventory means that they have often a massive amount of inventory on hand already purchased and ready to push out. Packaway accounted for around 43% of their overall inventory this quarter, so the impacts may not be seen until maybe next year if the tariffs are indeed implemented after all. This was mentioned by Rentler in the Q&A on the call. She said that basically they will watch full price retailers and adjust around that. So they're keeping a close eye on the market, which is an intelligent thing to do. With all of these worries, they are expecting earnings per share to be up just around 1-3% for the rest of the year, including the possibility of flat earnings per share in the fourth quarter. Not at all what Wall Street Trent wanted to see from an off-price retailer that's been doing very well over the past several years, adding stores left and right. Shares fell about $4, or around 4%, during trading on Friday after Thursday's call.
Let's talk about some of those initiatives they went through on the earnings call as well. In particular, Rentler noticed how impressed the company has been with the performance at Dd's Discounts, which Layton mentioned. And honestly, Layton, if you're in Colorado for a very long period of time, there's a few Dd's Discounts here to visit. Most notably, they just opened a location in Pueblo across from one of the few remaining Kmarts here in Colorado. But strong growth in sales there, operating profit as well, and that's being reflected in their growth plans going forward. Ross is planning to open 100 stores total in 2019. About 25% of them are Dd's locations, which makes up a larger percentage than their overall percentage of Dd's Discounts. And a noteworthy move here from a company where just a few years ago, Dd's made up just a small proportion of stores. You had pockets, like you mentioned, Southern California, Houston, but overall the company expects 90 net new openings in 2019 across their two brands. One interesting comment from the CEO, Rentler, is the fact that they have, and I quote, a long way to go as far as assortments in ladies' apparel. This is particularly intriguing because you look at the average Ross, ladies' apparel makes up the majority of the floor space there. In particular, Rentler said the issues needing to be addressed include what she called assortments below their normal standards. That's another quote. However, this might be helped along by what the company is calling a plentiful supply. Ross is seeing a lot of merchandise come through secondary channels, and they mentioned on the call that they figure to continue to see high available supply. Layton, this is all as a result of potential continued struggles in the department store space. So when we're talking about same-store sales falling at Sears and JCPenney and Macy's struggling a little bit, you go through all of those. Well, They've got some of the overstocks there. That's going to make more of that merchandise available to Ross. There might not be as much demand for the clothing manufacturers as well. Again, more merchandise coming available for brands like Ross or TJX. They also said that they have the liquidity to pounce on any short-term deals, which is crucial in this space. And they have space to add to their pack-away inventory if necessary. Layton talked about the 43% of inventory being pack-away earlier on. Now, leadership was asked about the uncharacteristically low same-store sales guidance for the second half of the year during the Q&A session. They basically said with the customer uncertainty and the uncertainty regarding potential impacts of tariffs on consumer confidence, they wanted to set a very conservative bar here. They didn't say outright they were sandbagging, but it looks kind of awfully close to that from a distance. One other quick note from the Q&A, they actually expect freight costs to decrease going forward. Most retailers actually guiding for an increase as a result of higher labor costs and potentially higher fuel costs. Ross, one of those few retailers, they think that freight costs will actually decrease for them. So let's move on now to the stage earnings call.
As we alluded to in a looking ahead segment a few months ago, it seemed to us that Stage was accelerating its conversion of full price stores to Gordman stores just based on the last guidance we saw from the company. This was actually proved correct, Trent, in this week's earnings call as they referenced a significant increase of focus towards the Gordman's conversions. As of the call, the company held 141 Gordman stores, a massive jump from the 30 to 40 stores that were still around after the Gordman's bankruptcy. This is a remarkable story of a bankrupt retailer helping to turn around a struggling company, even if it hasn't turned into a complete success story as of yet. We dig into the numbers, Trent, from this call. The headline for Stage was Stage Stores reports 1.8% second quarter comparable store sales increase. And this is big news indeed, following quarter after quarter of struggling comps for the retailer. Off-price conversions were said to benefit comps by 150 basis points, although it wasn't broken down exactly how much positivity Gordman's had versus the legacy brands.
However, net store sales were down from last year by $1 million, a product of several closed mainline stores. Additionally, the company's net loss widened from last year from $16.9 million to $23.9 million in this year's second quarter. On a per-share basis, the loss was 83 cents compared to 60 cents. So these numbers, honestly, are pretty bad. Why did the share price pop then last Wednesday on August 21st? Well, it's all about expectations. That loss per share came in slightly above expectations. They also revised upward their adjusted EBITDA to $20 to $25 million in the positive from $10 to $15 million. That's a fairly large leap for a company that struggled of late. They still project to close around 54 to 59 net stores in the year, but are now looking to convert nearly 100 full-price stores in total to Gordman's, far above what they were projecting early on in the year. Also, their comp sales include the impact from 35 of the converted stores being closed on average 10 days each during the conversion process in the quarter, basically as they were changing those from their full price stores to the Gordman stores, closed 10 days. Without this, look at it, the numbers might look even better for the company. So you might see that net loss, for example, shrink. You might see that loss of revenue go the other direction if those stores are open for a longer period of time. Finally, their comp sales in the first few weeks of the third quarter are up mid-single digits, which would be a massive company-wide increase, considering that it isn't just isolated to the Gordman's chain in that case. Now, one of the first things that CEO Michael Glazer mentioned on the call was the importance of home categories to their sales. The acquisition of Gordman's allowed Stage to add home products to their arsenal. Prior to that, most Stage full-price stores, whether that be Stage or Goody stores, any one of their other brands, didn't really offer a huge home selection. Glazer went so far as to call the home category the main catalyst for growth at the company, as they have invested in building out the selection, and as a result, the home sales have more than doubled, partly from the conversions, of course, but partly from the momentum in existing Gordman stores. Additionally, women's apparel showed improvement over the prior year's quarter, which has been a rarity. They actually mentioned an existing partnership with ThredUp as being a slight driver here. They actually had the original ThredUp partnership, you know, the one we talked about with JCPenney and Macy's. Well, honestly, Stage was first on that bandwagon. Dating from last year, they have it in 44 stores currently. Unlike with Target, credit card penetration at Stage and their assorted stores up over last year after a reissue of cards in July. Penetration sitting at 18% versus just 15% last year. Long-term goal is 25%. They want to leverage Goldman's existing customer base into this as well. And unlike with Ross, one thing they did mention, their distribution costs actually going up. Other costs of goods sold hindrances included inventory, which increased by 5%, but this was by design as they tried to get buys in before tariffs and distribution costs rose further. You know, if you have room in those distribution centers, why not stockpile before those tariffs go into place and slide in under the bar, so to speak, on those? So that's basically the story that we've got from Goldman's and Stage so far. Really anxious to see how this story continues and whether the turnaround continues in the next couple of quarters.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, speaking of looking ahead, we've reached that stage in the podcast where we look ahead to a story each Leighton and I will be keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year. I'll go ahead and start. You know, this week, because we delayed recording the podcast for so long, Costco actually opened up their first store in China to rave reviews. As such, we saw the share price increase big time on August 27th of 2019. The mind looking ahead is really about if Costco can expand this Chinese footprint. After all, we've got one store in the books from Costco, but the price to earnings ratio is now sitting at 36 for the stock, which is very high, as though Costco were a company still in aggressive growth mode, and that's really not honestly where we see Costco. They're a pretty mature retailer, particularly in the United States. We know that Chinese expansion might be a little bit longer, and certainly they're not going to be favorably viewed by the Chinese officials, at least one would guess as such, because of all the talk about tariffs. So a lot going on here in terms of Costco opening up some locations internationally. Historically, Costco has done pretty well in some international locations, but their bread and butter is still in the U.S. And here in the U.S., you're seeing those same store sales continue to jump, to continue to increase, but they're really not opening that many new stores. So really what I'm looking ahead to is all this market optimism about Costco. Is it valid? Will they continue to increase their Chinese presence seamlessly, or will they run into various hurdles there, and will they run into issues surrounding maybe adjusting their brand over in China as well?
My looking ahead story has to do with Ollie's Bargain Outlet, as their stock plunged almost 30% in after-hours trading after Wednesday's trading session, I should say. The company actually reported second quarter earnings of $25.3 million, and this was apparently a little bit shy of analyst expectations. You look here, Trent, revenue, $333.9 million, up from $288 million a year before during the same quarter. Ollie's reported earnings of 35 cents per share. This is the per share basis, of course, down 40 cents a share from a year ago. Analysts expected actually 7 cents more. So they missed widely on earnings per share, but the CEO noted that Ollie's facing a lot of new opening costs for their stores were on an exceptional growth track still, and that they have a lot of optimism within their particular brand, and that they have a lot of stores that are doing very well despite a lot of worries of cannibalization. And this is interesting to me because Ollie's is still a very new retailer, a retailer that is entering into a lot of new markets. To even talk about cannibalization at this stage in the game is a little bit interesting to me. That should be something that should be ignored for those analysts that are talking about that. But you look, Trent, they're taking over 13 former Toys R Us locations. That is going to be very expensive to set up their stores, do business, create that distribution. But the one positive takeaway, and this is why it's my looking ahead story, is that they said that despite their growth, they still have a ton of what they call deal flow. So in terms of supply chain, in terms of actual product assortment coming their way, they still have a ton of product that they can shelve on all of their new locations in all of their new markets. And I think that's extremely, extremely important because you're looking at a business that's really predicated upon buying very low and selling fairly low relative to their competition.
Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. A big thanks for Leighton stopping by my residence so that we could get this episode finally recorded. Hope he visits a lot of cool retailers here in Colorado while on this trip. For Leighton, I'm Trent, saying so long until next week. Big thanks to our sponsor, Blinkist, as well. We'll be back, hopefully, travel plans willing, about 7 days from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.